Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 19th, 2017, and welcome to episode 161 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, introducing new people to the hobby, and other such things. So, hello, I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by two people around the table. First, the familiar Jack Nutting from Stockholm. How are you?
Hey, Paul, I'm pretty good.
Excellent. And a special guest this week, we have Cindy Moya, the collections manager and chair of the acquisitions committee at the Living Computers Museum and Labs in Seattle. So how are you?
I am never better, Paul. Thank you.
Excellent. So we're happy to have you here. And I think the host's topic today is going to be just loosely around what is the Living Computers Museums and Labs in Seattle? What do you do there? Maybe actually one place to start before we even do that is to get some sense of you. How did you get to your current position? How did you become interested in computers and so forth?
Well, Paul, I grew up in my father's engineering manufacturing company in the 70s and 80s, and so I was around this stuff all of my life. It was like the air I breathed, and I watched and really participated in what I think is the development of the microcomputer industry. I studied history of science and technology when I went to the university, and got a degree in library and information science, and when I came out, I saw this cool job come across, catalog and house a collection of vintage microcomputers, parts and documents, and I really thought, boy, that if there was ever a job that was made for me, that was it, and there's been no turning back. It's been really a lot of fun. I've been here for 6 years now, and 7 years before that, I was a processing archivist doing that job. Mm-hmm. So I've been working with these materials for a long time, and particularly working with engineers and helping them restore the computers and find the software and equipment that they need for this.
Yeah, I'm sure that most of us on this side of the microphone and listening out there would think of this as a dream job. If we could just get paid to do this, this would be great. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, we have a really great time over here. We're fortunate to have a lot of resources, like 8 engineers full-time, plus the whole operation of the museum as well, which includes curators and education, marketing. I've got a crew of 2 or 3 archivists who are also working on this stuff. I mean, I've heard some interviews that you've also done with people who have big collections, like, what do you do with this stuff? And it's coming in really fast. Uh-huh. We have to figure out what to do with it. And if we don't stop bailing, we get buried in it. So it's pretty exciting, though.
So now, as far as the museum itself goes, so the Living Computers Museum and Labs, mm-hmm. So the mission of that, as I understand it, I guess it's sort of split, right? I mean, so there's a certain amount of preservation and archiving and categorization and things that are done, and also kind of an outreach kind of aspect to it as well, right?
Well, the museum is open Wednesday through Sunday from 10 to 5, and there's a big crew of tour guides and people who help guests. We've got probably 50 microcomputers, 10 mini computers, a supercomputer, all working, all available for people to use when they come in. That's the living part. Mm-hmm. This is not a static museum. It's you could liken the difference from, say, a natural history museum that computer history museum is like versus a zoo or a petting zoo that we have where you could actually touch and see the living things and work with the software and press the buttons. And so that's what we've got. That makes it actually very unique in museums, and particularly with computer museums, that we have so many resources behind making them run and making them available. We also make them, a lot of the time, sharing computers available online. So you could go, you yourself can go and get an account and try out, you know, TOPS 10 or Unix System 7 or some other things like that that are really cool.
So you mentioned you actually have 8 engineers working full-time on staff. So basically their jobs are just restoring and maintaining and keeping operating all these old machines.
Yes.
See, that's...
That's exactly right.
That seems just amazing. Every job within this museum seems like an amazing job. Just like, I mean, and I think one of the fascinating things about this whole thing is, like, I go to a lot of museums. My wife is a museum professional. I go to a lot of museums, and frequently, like, whatever computer displays that they have of anything, what is, you know, a new computer displaying some animated something, some interactive thing, at least a third of the time, these things are just broken. And it's not even an old computer that requires any sort of effort. It's just like it's something that's running a bad version of Windows and something has crashed and whatever, and it's all behind a, you know, there's no keyboard, there's no mouse, there's just a touch screen that is broken. And
well, I got to tell you, museum people, they can't help themselves. They want to make these interactives where you like touch screen and press buttons to learn things on some computer where you're looking at pictures. It doesn't make sense to me, I must say, but museum people, they have to do it.
Yep.
And it's difficult to keep them running because quite often it's a bespoke, you know, custom thing that, you know,
sure,
it's delivered to the museum and no one knows how to make it go once it's there. So, you know, we have all these engineers who are working. They're restoring the stuff. There's a big ticketing system, so when things are broken, they fix them immediately. We have a goal of 95% uptime. So I think we're fulfilling it pretty good, too.
It sounds amazing. This is one of the first things I've ever heard of that makes me feel like I really want to visit Seattle. Very cool.
So do you... You know, one aspect of this, it seems to me, is that this kind of a place would be the place where you could get children or younger people interested in this. And I'm wondering if you find, you know, what your experience is with that. Because, of course, that's obviously whatever future this has, it's eventually going to have to be handed off to them.
Well, there's certainly a lot of things about that that's important. You know, we have a big education department now. So we've got some beautiful state-of-the-art classrooms, education coordinator, a curriculum. Kids are churning through here all the time, learning more contemporary things quite often, you know, robots, soldering, Raspberry Pi. We just had a huge event with Minecraft. So there's a lot of contemporary stuff getting kids interested in engineering and technology, and we're searching for ways, the educators are, to reach out and say, use these older computers like IBM 5150. Mm-hmm. Say, this is what it looked like then. This is how the boards plug in. This is, you know, the 5150 doesn't have extra memory, but, you know, maybe a later one will. This is how the memory plugs in, and how it all fits together, because, you know, at least you can see it. It's macro enough.
Right.
Now, your phone, you can't see any of that stuff. But in some of these things, like, you know, like the early IBM, or you go even earlier, like these great PDP computers, there's so much air in there, and it's so macro. You could practically see the electrons going down the pipes, you know, that what's happening. So I think that there is a lot of possibility there that we need to tap into more. And, you know, as for getting, you know, getting kids interested, there's a lot of effort going on to there. You know, part of it is also how do we get older people interested as well, people who already have the skills to come in and share with us their skills. and understanding of how to run this software, how to restore these old things, or, you know, we're particularly looking for people to do mechanical things like printers, chain printers, green bar printers. Those things are really pain to keep running. And the knowledge is very intricate and precise for them, or for like a card sorter, a card punch. I mean, you can learn it out of a book, but getting that last few millimeters from a real expert who is in it is something we're looking to capture as well.
Yeah, definitely. Part of the issue, I'm sure we're all aware, is just that many of the people who were experts in the old stuff have continued to be in the industry and have moved on and don't do that stuff anymore and aren't interested in it. So I guess part of it is we have to hit people in the kind of like the nostalgia point. But yeah, it's definitely, that's one concern, is just that there's a kind of a limited time to collect this expertise. And so it's good that there are a few places that are really sort of trying to gather it.
I don't think it's ultimately impossible. One of the things we collect is the manuals, the parts, the parts manuals, the spare parts, the instructions, student guides. And I think people, ordinary mortals, people trained as engineers, can go and use these manuals and learn how to run this equipment, even with a gap of expertise. We certainly did it with our CDC 6500, the people who originally used that computer and cut the cables with bolt cutters between the frames said, there's no way you're ever going to get this thing back together. But, we used the manuals, and we did. So I believe it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's. I think I remember talking about that at some point. Some past episode, but it sounds like an just astounding job. I mean, congratulations to all involved on getting that going. But I guess it's true that it is a proof of concept that it is. You can work with these manuals. Hopefully, the thing is that the experts know. Oh, well, the diagram on page 16 actually had this reversed, and so. I like that one aspect of the fact that you're having these running is that you're in a better position to catch that. That if there is something, some piece of information that you need from an expert, you will find out sooner.
Yes, I think that is really interesting.
So you came to this from sort of a library science background. I assume a large part of the task is figuring out how to categorize what you have, how to know what you have, and how to know what you're missing, and that sort of thing. How does that work? Is that too hard, too big of a question?
Well, it started off with some trial and error. I looked for other examples of libraries that held computer equipment and cataloged it, libraries that held just equipment and how they organized it. And then after a while, I just had to do it. Mm-hmm. And, I made a lot of mistakes. One of the great benefits I had is after a couple of years, I started having users, genuine engineers who had questions, who were trying to do things, which is a real blessing to an archivist, because then I have something to orient my records towards. Like, I know they're going to look first thing for a power supply, information on the power supply. So I make sure if I see something about a power supply, I make a note of that in the record. So when they search, they'll find the power supply info. Mm-hmm. And it just other simple things like that. And, the longer I've been doing it, the more I have been able to grok holes, which I couldn't see it as clearly when I first started. But seeing the whole thing that comes in, we've gotten some really excellent sets of stuff that, you've got the computer and then a bunch of software on funny carriers and then a bunch of technical drawings and microfiche and manuals, and it all fits together. And the person who gives it to you will say something that didn't make any sense until I started looking at this stuff, like, this piece is really important, or you'll really want to know about how you know, this tiny little connector works. You're going to need tons of these to close the doors. So being open to these details has really improved my ability to help the engineers. But, you know, how to do it, right? Do I do it by making a finding aid? Do I do it by making a catalog record? Do I do it by, you know, collecting every communication that the person gave to me and putting it somewhere so someday somebody, engineer, restoring this, is going to find that thing and see, you know, the one sentence that, you know, clears everything up? It's really hard to know. Sometimes you just have to summarize and hope for the best.
Uh-huh.
And come back to it, or the engineers will come back to it and say, this is really important. Make sure to make a note of this.
Yeah, well, I know that I've definitely had, I've fought with this in my own, like on a smaller scale in my own stuff, because I have lots of things which are, you know, there's a computer that has a couple of different cards in it, and I want to kind of keep track of both what cards I have and what revisions of the cards I have and what computer they're in. And, you know, sometimes there are little modifications made to computers. So somewhere I need to have a note of this. And just finding the right grain size is really tricky. And actually, you know, noticing, oh, actually these two things I thought were the same are different revisions of some kind. I mean, you know, I'm just aware of the magnitude of the problem. But
yeah, and I think especially considering like some of the items that we've looked at, things found on eBay and elsewhere, you find things that are heavily modified and without any sort of provenance, without any sort of any documentation of, okay, what is this modification about? It can be extremely challenging to understand, okay, which, is this even useful? Like, what have I got here? Is it something that somebody was tinkering with and ended up just breaking it? Or is it something that is actually an interesting modification that we will never know about? We'll never know its function because it's undocumented and we're missing the software. There's so many unknowns, the kind of the unknown unknowns that, like, we don't even know what we don't know.
Right.
Yeah, that is so true. You know, we get these things sometimes and you can see that it's been modified. People have soldered on wires and traces to change it. And, you know, is that just a rev or something special or a mistake?
Hmm. Right.
You know, our engineers have certainly found that too, like overriding power supply things instead of fixing it.
Right. It's certainly possible that the individuals who originally owned this might, you know, have skipped the relevant class that they would have learned the right answer in. So, it is interesting. I think it's quite possible that when getting things from eBay, you have that even more. I mean, like it's always somebody found it at an estate sale, or, you know, this was grandpa's old weird thing in the attic and nobody knows what it is, you know, a lot of times things are just completely mismatched. It's just the stuff that was in the box together. The detective work is interesting, but sometimes it's pretty frustrating that you'll never know the story for some of this stuff. Let's see. Another thing that might be interesting to talk about would be just some of the, some of the restoration work. You made a note here that you've done some work on the Bendix G15 and some sort of older stuff, older, larger stuff.
Yes, yeah, some restorations that are in progress right now is a Bendix G15D, which is a vacuum tube computer from 1956. This one, like many computers, first they had to replace all the power supplies. Mm. And, that's just one of the things we do. It might be controversial for some people. They might, other hobbyists or restorers might just reformat the capacitors and hope for the best. But we're, trying not to kill our visitors.
Right.
So it's less explosive, say, with a contemporary power supply in there, and a little more dependable and greener, uses a lot less energy. Mm-hmm. So the power supply took a lot of effort. This G15 has got a little drum memory in it, which is remarkable in that it still works. It's all sealed up, and it's maintained its integrity. One of the issues with it is the germanium diodes, all the 1950s vintage germanium diodes, all puked. So there's all these modules, and they each have four tubes on the end of it, and then there's a little board, and then there's some diodes. And so he had to replace all those germanium diodes, like 3,009 of them, with resoldering in contemporary ones. And then he's finding that the solder generally on the modules is bad, right? It's come delaminated, and so there's a lot of resoldering going on now, and it's improving, right? It's almost a computer now, after a good year that he's been working on this thing. They use paper tapes in cartridges, so it's a pretty unique, one-of-a-kind software carrier. But they're still really intact. They're very robust, these paper tapes. They must be waxed or something. They're not metal, but they're very nice paper. So we have a lot of software with that. So that's coming along. It's a very charismatic computer if you go look it up in on Wikipedia. The one you see on Wikipedia is one of ours. We have three of them now. Usually we try to get two or three of something if we're going to restore it and put it on the floor. So we have, you know, an index copy and one for spares and, you know, the one to really muck around with. There's another really great piece we got, an IBM 36030, which came, we bought sight unseen from a garage in North Carolina. It came with all the ALDs and a bunch of software, cables. Wonderful, except garages in North Carolina are very moist. So this thing was covered, it was fulminating with mold. So we had to really hustle to get that thing contained and bring in some professionals to clean off that mold for, you know, a couple weeks or so. But now it's in our second floor computer room, and the engineer is working on it. I think it's got a really great memory in it, the CCROS, or CCROS, I think it's called, the Card Capacitance Read-Only Storage, which is just an amazing thing. These cards, they look like punch cards, except they're clear Mylar and have traces, gold traces printed on them and punches on them. And so it's maybe, I don't know, 10 by 5, this matrix in which these cards go in, and there's a vacuum that when you turn it on, the vacuum sucks those cards against their sensors. And it's really neat. So, and I guess you can change out the cards depending on what sort of memory you want to be in there. But our engineer is, they do emulations on top of it, so he's trying to get a basis board to emulate the memory and tap that in there, just to try to make it work right now. And then he'll work on this CCROS later. But it's moving along. One of our big projects that we're going to start doing next year is an IBM 7090, which we got from Australia. It was originally used at Woomera for calculating missile trajectories. That's in Adelaide, Australia, near Adelaide. Woomera, I've just been learning about it. It's kind of like the Area 51 of Australia. It was a really fascinating thing going on over there. And at the time that this was decommissioned in around the late 60s, an engineer who was working on it bought it at auction for a dollar. And he put it in his pole barn, it being, you know, 25 giant frames and the IBM 1401 and 11 tape drives, and all the documents, all the cables, all this software, disk packs. And he put it in his pole barn thinking, oh, I'm going to recommission this in some sort of a museum. But as you probably know, this is a much more difficult task than just, oh, let's recommission it. Right? But he kept it for 40 years, and eventually we bought it so that we can recommission it. And this thing, let me tell you, it's covered in koala poop and wallaby urine and, you know, God only knows what, you know. And we had our remediation people spend probably 4 weeks straight, four people, 40 hours a week, just wiping this thing. Right, and they couldn't even, it's still kind of rusted shut, so they couldn't even get inside. But, this is going to be a fun restoration. This will be a big deal. I'm really looking forward to, it's probably take maybe 3 to 5 years to get this thing up and running. But we've got a nice team working on it. Hopefully we'll, maybe we'll even be able to upgrade it to a 7094 and do some time sharing.
Huh. Yeah, I'm looking at a couple of pictures of this, and these look, it looks quite impressive. Many, many little switches and things.
Yeah, just the operator console is like a whole big desk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, yes, that console is really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking a little bit about the, like when you were saying it's possible to get timesharing accounts and things like that on some of the machines that you have, just, you know, even though we have, I would say, a more sophisticated understanding of how computers work and that kind of thing now than we did in the 1960s when they were just getting started, you know, I bet there's still a pretty steep learning curve in trying to figure out how to make the thing do its thing and, you know, to understand all the acronyms that they used at the time and stuff. So even if you have the manual, you still need the 3 months to understand it.
Well, yeah, I tell you, I spent my first couple years here doing deck things, and they have so many abbreviations. Mm-hmm. Digital Equipment Corporation, you know, the RPO6 and the TU55 and the TC10 and the this and that, and it's dizzying. It really is, and it took many years for me to be able to make sense of that.
Yeah, although I think the IBM 360 type stuff is even worse. Everything is just known by some number and different, you know, off by one, and that's an entirely different kind of thing.
Right, right. The 1401 is one thing, and the 1402 is something else, and the 03 is a printer. And why?
Yeah, I did look up the photo of at least a Bendix G15. And at least the one that I'm looking at, I don't know if it's yours or not, but it's in this 1960s blue. It's or teal, maybe it is.
Right, teal, and it's got rounded corners. It's like an old Chevy or something.
Right.
It needs wings.
Right, some spoilers of some kind or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's and the, you know, the terminal. It's just a typewriter, the keyboard, but yeah, it's beautiful. It is. I mean, you bring up in there somewhere the interesting question of what you're trying to do when you're doing a restoration. I mean, like the LCM and L is itself, you know, kind of trying to make sure something works, and so you do replace things that are broken, and possibly replace them with newer things just so that it will function like it used to. But the goal is essentially to be able to use it like you were able to use it in the past?
Yes. Yes, that is part of the goal. I think one of the philosophies of restoring it is we imagine, you know, what would an engineer at that time who's trying to repair this computer do?
Right.
Right, and they would probably put in a new power supply. They would probably add components that are more dependable.
Uh-huh.
You know, after a while, you know, it's something else entirely, but it's certainly going to be fun while it lasts.
Right, right. Well, and I think you had mentioned you have a panel that is running Multics. I forget exactly how this was supposed to work, but maybe you could tell me about this. Oh, Honeywell 6180 maintenance panel. That's it.
Right. Right. Well, we helped fund the writing of the Multics emulator that is now on multicians.org. I don't want to take too much credit for that because I'm not entirely sure of the history. But one thing we did do is we got this Honeywell 6180 panel, which is, it's not a thing that you would see if you were using the Honeywell computer. It's behind a door, but the you know, the customer engineer would open the door and see this panel, which has a ton of blinky lights, mm-hmm. which is run by the software. And so our engineers took this panel, the real piece, and rewired it into a again a basis board, which is an emulator of some sort. And which was a very intricate, because there were hundreds of these wires that were all white going to all the different lights. And, you know, carefully wired that in there so that it's now meaningful. All the blinky lights on this panel are meaningful to running the software. So if you happen to be running a, you know, some sort of Multics program, using that panel, it can help you troubleshoot the computer. It could also help you troubleshoot your program, depending on the kind of lights that are going on. We're eventually going to put a camera on that and allow people to log in to the Multics emulator. And so you can watch on the camera what's going on in the blinky lights and run Multics as well.
That sounds so cool.
Nice.
That would be very fun to try.
Yeah, we've got a IBM 360-91 panel mm-hmm. that is it's just wired up to be blinky, right? And it does these sort of blinky patterns that are not meaningful. But we've got a plan to get an IBM 360-91 emulator wired into that panel so it does a similar thing. So it's not just, you know, high and blinky, but it's meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have. Well, actually, both Michael Mulhern. It's too bad that he's not here, because he maybe could have talked a little bit about the barn rescue, too. But yeah, he and I both have one of these things called a PIDP8, which is it's basically a front panel with lights and switches that is behind it is a Raspberry Pi running a PDP8 simulator. Same kind of thing, but neither of us have built ours yet. And much smaller scale.
We have one of the earlier ones, the Spare Time Gizmos.
Uh-huh.
That's also a PDP-8 emulator. That is, I think it's 3/4 size, and it does have switches on the front panel. So I like these kind of mixed projects where you have this contemporary technology, and yet you're using the old stuff. There is another division in our company that's working on a augmented reality Altair B, 8080B, where somehow it'll help you tell you what switches to flip on the Altair in order to say, do the boot sequence or something.
Right. That's excellent. That's back in the actual day, people would probably more or less have memorized how to toggle in a bootloader, but that's a bit of an ask for just a visitor to the museum. Okay, memorize this. That's very cool. I'm noticing that we're just talking about this, and it's possible that we should maybe move on. But is there anything else that you wanted to mention in this part while we're focused on the Living Computers Museum and Labs?
Well, the hardware is only part of the story, mm-hmm. and restoring, getting the software running, is another huge part of it as well. And we have spent some considerable effort tracking down software items that were considered lost, mm-hmm. and making them available to the general public now. So other people are doing that as well. I think Computer History Museum has got like Word 1.0 source and things like that. But we got some really cool things too, like this TOPS 10, TOPS 20. Weights is really important. I don't know if you know about weights, but that was a precursor to TOPS 20. There's some... one of our engineers spent many years getting this thing written, not just to SimAge, which would have been easier, but really to the actual PDP-10 that we have running now. So it's running on one that is not available to the public yet, but we're going to set that loose sometime soon. And so there's some great opportunities for people who are studying these old operating systems to get accounts. In some ways, we are a solution waiting for a problem. And I'm looking, you know, I want students, I want engineers, I want people to come here and use our stuff and find ways, fun things to do with it, to use it to teach about old architectures or new things that can be done with these old computers. There's a lot of prospects for, say, art, film, literature, English, media studies. We've got a lot of possibilities here, and we finally kind of firmed up into a real thing where we're prepared for researchers and visitors to come and use this collection, and a hobbyist as well. I want to call out to your audience and say, please think of us, because we're not just doing this to show off. You know, we want to make this available to other people to do something with. And I'm not even exactly sure what this doing something is going to be, but I'm sure people in your audience are going to be able to think of something even more wonderful.
Cool. So I know that a lot of us, you know, Jack and me, and a lot of the other sort of participants here, kind of got into this, you know, as kids from the home computer angle, and my, at least for me, there's a big gap in all the big iron. You know, I've made SimH run a couple times, you know, but I don't know anything about TOPS, or I mean, like, apart from the name, TOPS 10, TOPS 20 weights. But I would like to learn about it. I am a little intimidated by all of it, but it's great that there is this resource.
It's you know, I tell you what, it's easier to get an account and log into TOPS 10 here at the museum than it is to figure out how to install SimH.
I could believe that. It did take me quite a while to actually get anything up and running on SimH.
But. Yeah, I mean, considering you have systems that are up and running and available for use and are not things that need to be sort of installed and configured and figure things out, plus running on the actual hardware, which just makes it even that much cooler.
Yeah. All right. So I'll go ahead and sort of like move to the next section in the show notes, but there's plenty of time still to talk.
Thank you for letting me go on. Apparently I can talk about this all afternoon. I'm really excited about this museum and what we're doing.
Oh yeah, and we're delighted to have you talk about it.
Yep, it's great to hear.
So I'll mention quickly. It's been a while since we've recorded, and so there's a bit of listener feedback that has come in. I'll kind of run through some of it quickly. Mark Lemmert wrote, who we had on in a previous episode talking about Nox Archaeist. He wrote to mention that the Kickstarter that he talked with us about at the time didn't reach its goal, but there was enough interest that they're proceeding with two additional team members and an intent to reboot that campaign in the future. So it's still a very interesting project, but they're kind of reworking how this will work as far as the product creation goes. Also, Blake wrote in on Twitter to tell us that he owns both of the Asteroids and Centipede watches that were mentioned before. I think, Jack, you had, in fact, brought them up.
Right.
And he says that he owns them, and they're cool, but you can't play them.
That's too bad.
So, yeah. So, oh well. Jim wrote to us on Twitter to say something that we've heard periodically, which is that he misses the videos. So you can't see anyone holding things up in the audio only podcast. And so David Grealish wrote to remind the world that the old videos are still there. So if you want to look at, you know, vintage RCRs, there's a YouTube channel. We'll have a link in the show notes that have the shows from number 30 to number 57, which spans a little over a year from July 2012 to September 2013. We periodically do kind of think about what it would take to get back to doing the videos.
Yeah, we've talked about it, and I think we've ended up theorizing about what software to use and how to do it and stuff, and then it's kind of just fallen on the floor again.
Yeah.
This actually, so, if any listeners know, if anyone out there says, hey, all you need to do is run this thing, you bunch of doofuses, and it will work, please let us know.
Yeah, I think the goal would be, I mean, the goal of before, too, was essentially we record like we always record. It's an audio podcast primarily, except that there would be maybe some little time at the beginning and end, you know, on video where you can sort of watch us do it, but the actual audio product would still be edited in the same way, you know,
right.
and may not actually sync up with the video for that reason.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, yeah, I think what went wrong was essentially that it became difficult to deal with YouTube. I think YouTube was the broadcasting thing that we were using, and trying to get Skype and YouTube and everything to work together wasn't working so well. But anyway, thanks, Jim. We know, and we will. We're still thinking about it. So, Kevin wrote an email to suggest a discussion topic, which we may still do, but related to using emulators inside mobile devices. And he's released a ZX81 emulator for iOS and wanted to kind of look and see what other emulators there were. We'll have a link to his emulator, but he was finding it kind of frustrating that there wasn't a very good list of what kind of emulators are there out there for iOS and Android. And sort of separately, iOS is really a fairly hostile environment for emulators. Apple kind of did not allow them for a while. And then I think it's easier to get them in now, except that also just because these are hobby projects, they end up being things that have not made the jump to iOS 11, where I think it's 64-bit only. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of apps that were submitted before just have sort of silently stopped working on iOS 11. And one of the ones Kevin mentioned was the Jupiter Ace emulator for the iPad. And so I got it from my desk and took three steps over to my friend Edward, who wrote that, and said, hey, why isn't this out on iOS 11? He's like, oh, right, I forgot. And then he pointed me to the GitHub repository. He said, you know, all you have to do is go there, clone that, and build it and see if it works. So, Kevin, if you feel like it, you can actually grab the source to the Jupiter Ace iPad app. I guess you can't submit it on Edward's behalf, but the solution is not too far away. But I think, yeah, it's like you said, hobbyist stuff, it's easy to get in a spot where you release something on iOS and then later you just kind of, you know, if it's not earning a lot of money, kind of forget about it. Like, I have some apps that I released. They're not emulators, kind of off subject here, but just things that I created and released in 2009 and got an email from Apple a year ago saying, hey, you need to update this, and if you don't, we're going to take it off the App Store. And then I found, okay, I haven't changed anything in this app in however many years, and suddenly the latest developer tools won't build it cleanly, and everything's half broken, and I spend an hour trying to fix it, and I say, oh, not worth the trouble. So that's actually an interesting point that is unrelated to emulators in general, but just the fact that things on iOS have a tendency to artificially degrade or like get to the point where Apple will no longer accept it anymore. Apple, since they're the gatekeeper, they can decide, hey, this old thing of yours, you haven't changed it in such a long time. We're not gonna make it for sale anymore. And so actually, I have some stuff that I wrote, those old apps of mine, that right now I have no way to run them because they don't run on any of the iPhone devices that I have today. And like, the source code is not compilable on any Mac that I have these days. I'd have to install like an old version of macOS on a machine, which means I'd have to have a laptop from 6 years ago, and just like, it's frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, so the retro computing of the future is, you know, as we've often noted, going to be terrible.
Yes.
But yeah. Yeah, it was just actually at the Apple Store with my wife's machine called MacBook Pro, you know, I mean, so that tells you it can't be that old, but of course it's as far as they're concerned, it's, I forget, they have a term for this, but it's basically beyond obsolete. they won't, you know, they said, take it to some other dealer.
Okay.
What was it? Anyway, it doesn't matter, but you know, it's not obsolete. It's something else. But
deprecated.
It might be that. Yeah.
That is really interesting to hear this happening. It's so contemporary, and all of the, you know, I'm working with these older softwares that only run on particular types of computers that, you know, 5 1/4-inch disks and things like that, that everybody's files are receding into the past. You can't open them anymore. The only thing that's really good is paper to have your documents on, and it's just still, it's happening even faster, an accelerated rate with apps and phones.
Right.
Right, but it's not actually any sort of real technological degradation. It's more someone being in the middle saying, this does not apply to this marketplace anymore, therefore it's going away. Kind of sad.
Right.
Right, right. Your phone is 2 years old, yeah. So of course it's not going to display funny characters on your Kindle.
Okay, and then I guess maybe the last thing. I have to say I didn't entirely understand the email, but Andy wrote in to propose a kind of a metric for one's, I guess, measuring one's retrocomputing essence. But and the actual metric, you know, involves things like desire to discover what you missed and determination of understanding what you couldn't at the time. So maybe you're more mentally evolved in some way at this point than you were as a child. And the, also the need to preserve our electronic heritage, our computational heritage, all sort of filtered through the availability of resources to spend on these things. And he converted these into numbers in a way that I didn't fully understand, but I think all of those factors are right. I mean, you know, that although one thing that I was thinking of when I was reading through this was that I'm actually, like, thinking back to how old I was when I was using these home computers and the kind of sophistication of all the assembly programming and stuff that I was doing. It's like, you know, actually it's quite possible that kids can be pretty sophisticated. I mean, like, I don't think I was by myself, you know, I wasn't a, like, wunderkind or something, you know. It's possible for eighth graders to do assembly language programming and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I don't feel like I'm that much more sophisticated now, really.
Yeah, I think it's mostly a matter of resources and having some understanding of the context. Like, it's one thing to sort of generally understand how assembly language works, which I remember I got as a kid. Like, I totally understood the distinction between machine language and BASIC, and I read some stuff about assembly, but the actual context of how to put this into practice, how to actually use this on my Atari 8-bit computer, like, what to do with, you know, where am I going to put this assembly code, and how am I going to make this affect the screen, all this stuff. And I didn't have anyone nearby who was knowledgeable. I didn't have the right books. I didn't know what the right books were to buy to even find this stuff out. So it's sort of just a general lack of knowledge, which today I could fix all that. But just like you said, I don't think that I would not be a magically better assembly programmer today than I was 30 years ago. I guess I'd be a bit better, but like, if I had the right stuff around at the time, I probably could have done pretty well.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, presumably there's I feel like we talked about this sometime recently too, but, you know, there's some things that computer science has given us that we didn't have before, you know, that, you know, some ways of thinking of algorithms or making things more modular and that kind of stuff.
That's true.
All right. Okay. So that's, you know, thank you everybody for providing the feedback. And at the end, I'll tell you, you know, how you can provide us with more, but we appreciate hearing from people. So now we can move on to the items of interest and news, the various news items that have come up. Okay, Jack, you have the first one.
Yeah, so the first thing that I have here is something that I first came across maybe a month ago, maybe a bit more than a month ago. We've missed some show recording dates here, so I haven't talked about it yet. This is something called the 1088 XEL, and what this is a project to let you build an Atari 8-bit computer inside a mini ITX format. So kind of this standard size for making a small PC in a box. And basically what it is you can acquire this circuit board and stick your chips in it. So you use actually the actual chips from Atari 8-bit computer, the Pokey and the CPU and things, and along with some other stuff. And you assemble this kit that you can then put inside of a little box, and it will have this incorporates a number of enhancements that have been filtering through the Atari community for a long time. So things like a built-in CF card reader, and there's a better video out, and I think this might have the if I'm not totally wrong, it might have the stereo Pokey, where you basically have, you can have stereo output and double the number of audio channels that you would normally have. So it's a pretty neat project, and apparently the, I guess they started shipping beta boards to people sometime maybe a month or two ago. And I think they have what is what are now considered to be production-ready things ready to go. Kind of cool. And it's it incorporates things like a standard PS2 keyboard interface, which is another, again, this is something that's been available as an add-on for an Atari computer for a long time, but has not been standardized in the way that it is now. So kind of neat. Lets you take sort of all your Atari 8-bit goodness that you want to have and stick it in one little box. And I have not bought one of these. I haven't tried this out or anything. I've seen some promising reports of people messing with this on Facebook and stuff. So looks pretty cool.
So do you need to source real Atari chips to build this, though?
Yes, I believe you do. So if like you buy this kit, you have to have the chips. And I don't know if the, I don't know if that means you need to have, I don't know what is the best, like if you're going to buy one Atari 8-bit computer and pull the chips out, I don't know if there's one that's better than another. I haven't really read into it enough yet to see. And I don't know how extensive this kit is to build. I think it's probably pretty time-consuming to build this. It's not something you can't sort of pop this together in an hour.
Right.
But it looks like a pretty interesting and fun project for the right kind of person.
Well, certainly if you had, you know, some sort of confirmed dead Atari 8-bit somewhere.
Right. For some people who have stacks of these things and they know, okay, here's one that's good, except the keyboard is trashed and the SAO port is broken or whatever. Like, fine, I can take all the chips out of that and put it into this.
Right. Yeah, and I think I have a couple of sort of smashed ones.
Yeah,
yeah, LCM&L has been considering collecting some of these new projects that you're seeing out there proliferating, because there's so many neat things like this one. And of course we've got, you know, broken things that we could use to make this thing run.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about these, this project and projects like these, is that they are, in most cases, they're sort of amateur projects, you know, so these are not you know, corporate engineers making these things. There's sort of people doing these on the side. And so, you know, like, I never know for sure. It could be that, to some extent, these projects are less difficult than I imagine them to be. But the idea of my sort of making some sort of board that works, but missing something that would cause it to eventually fry someone's, you know, chips or something, that seems like a very real possibility.
Right.
And so I worry a little bit about, you know, it's great that people are enthusiastic enough to do these things, and they may well, most of them may know what they're doing enough that there's not that kind of problem. But I would love to kind of get started. And it's easy now to get OSH Park, you know, to build your little circuit boards for you and stuff. Mm. So I could do it, but I still worry that I never was trained.
Right. Yeah, and I think whoever is behind this website, ataribits.weebly.com, this guy named Michael St. Pierre, I don't really know, I haven't really read his whole story, but I assume he has some amount of training in terms of electronics, and he's done a number of other Atari mods, like the PS2 keyboard interface and this dual Pokey interface. So he's been working with this stuff for a while, and this latest thing seems to be the product of him kind of putting all this stuff together and thinking about what more to do with it. But yeah, like to me, it seems like the step from being where I am to being able to make a design for a small motherboard like this seems just insurmountable. Like, I don't know. How to get from point A to point B seems almost impossible, even though I have some training and I have, you know, a little amount of digital electronics experience in my education, but it's a pretty big step.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I don't mean to cast any suspicion on this particular project, because, I know I thought about that when I thought, oh, it'd be, you know, like, I have some prototype boards for Apple II, you know, the Apple II, it'd be kind of fun to wire some stuff up. And, but the jump to, I will now give it to other people is a scary one. But yeah, so as far as like gathering these things. The other aspect of all these kind of hobbyist projects is that they can be pretty fleeting. Often we have sort of encouraged the idea of if you see it and you think you might someday want it, you should get it because it may stop being available. There's plenty of sort of like CF card solutions and things like that that are in very sporadic runs or they just no longer are possible to get.
Right.
Let's see. So I guess I have the next one. This is actually sort of just a short note, but on Floppy Days number 78, so this was from the end of October, Randy Kindig interviewed Stuart Chaffee, who is one of the hosts of the Computer Chronicles, which is a very long-running, hopefully everybody knows the Computer Chronicles. It was wonderful. But the interview is really quite interesting. He talks kind of about how he got into it and, you know, a couple of the background stories. And he's still out there giving talks and stuff. So it's definitely worth listening to, particularly if you're already familiar with the Computer Chronicles, because it's, you know, fun to hear him talk. He still sounds like him. Are you guys familiar with the show?
Yeah, I remember watching it back in the day, now and then. Like, I didn't watch it regularly, but I remember seeing it now and then.
I'm actually not familiar with that.
Oh, it's... Well, you're lucky
I'll
you.
I'll have to take a look. I know. What a new exciting thing.
Yeah. There are probably hundreds of hours of it. I think it was weekly. A weekly sort of contemporary tech show. But it was... I'm not sure when it started, but it was in the late 80s. It was being actually, it was airing on PBS stations and stuff. This is part of the interview, but he talks a little bit about how originally there was kind of just presentations to a user group, and people said, you know, the world might want to hear this too, and eventually got it on a local channel, and then got sold to, I think it was distributed by PBS, And so this is one of the things that's great about it is it really does document at the time, you know, video of the things as they are coming out. So you can see people coming in and demonstrating the new, you know, Apple II GS or the new whatever they were, the PS2s. So it's a lot of fun. It's a big time sink,
yeah.
But it's a lot of fun. And the Internet Archive has all the episodes, I think, digitized there. And YouTube has a kind of like pirated version of the Internet Archive ones. So if you like the YouTube interface better, you can use that. Although I think the Internet Archive ones are the official ones.
It's very nice. It's like a time capsule of what people were using computers for and thinking about when it came to computers back at that time.
Well, that sounds great. I'll have to make sure to take a look at that.
And Jack, you have the next thing on the...
Yeah.
I don't even know what number that is. Atari did this too, with these like numbers that are you know, differ by one and are meaningfully like an entirely different peripheral.
Right. Yeah, so Atari, one of their things was the 1027 letter quality printer. And this was, I think it was not a dot matrix printer. It had like a rubber print head to stamp out, you know, good quality letters. The problem with this is that this has been sometimes referred to as the self-destructing printer because it's over time that rubber printhead wears out and just like makes the thing makes it fall apart. But very recently, some enterprising souls have decided to make a new run of these. Basically, what they've done is 3D printed in silicone new printheads. So if you have an old 1027 Well, any old 1027 that still exists today is probably non-functional because of the broken, the old rubber printer head, which probably has oxidized and fallen apart. But now you can actually buy some of these. And if you don't want to, if you can't, I don't know if they're still collecting for the print or for the run of this now. They're going to make a bunch. Let's see. Now they're collecting order until the 12th of November. That's already been. But otherwise, the source files are available somewhere, so you can 3D print these yourself if you have the right equipment, I guess. And, so there's a way to bring these things back to life, which is interesting because I've seen this printer talked about. I never had one of these. I've seen it talked about pretty recently over the past year or two, people just complaining about this thing falling apart because they really loved it. And you can make yourself have one in working order again now. Mm-hmm. So kind of cool.
Yeah, I've heard of these complaints, you know, like, I've looked at the printers and thought about getting them. And you know, I guess I must have seen somewhere, people saying just understand that they none of them work anymore.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I saw a great video. I thought it was linked from one of your articles here in the last couple of years, showing this Atari printer and how the print head just fell apart. And it was really fascinating. So it's really neat to see that somebody has made a thing to make them work again. Yep. Because, I mean, they're pretty cute little printers. They're kind of like the Okidatas. Mm-hmm. They're so compact. And
yeah, it was really a tiny little thing. I think it was such a simple construction that it was didn't require much, didn't take up a lot of space. And for if you were, you know, if you wanted to have letters and are okay with just being stuck to one font, there you go. So yeah, it's cool that coming back to life in a way here.
Yeah, and I mean, I think so. This kind of thing is fairly common for also like tape decks and things. You know, that so far I haven't come across them, but I've heard plenty of people, you know, talking about the little rollers on the tape decks just melting into goop.
Hmm.
So.
There's a place called Terry's Rubber Rollers that is the go-to place. Terry is like one guy will refinish your rollers for, you know, your tape drives. Particularly, I mean, we need them for you know, those big 9-track tape drives, mm-hmm. or even for, say, an 082 card sorter. There's all these rubber rollers that are in your moving equipment and your vintage computers. And Terry is the guy who will refinish your rubber rollers. But, you know, I'll tell you, that's a piece of expertise that there is only one person who has it.
Well, that's kind of frightening, but it's great that it's there
yes.
now.
Yeah, I know, really.
But it's interesting because I think that every, like, DeskJet printer that I've bought in the past 15 years, that's been the source of it stopping working eventually, is that the rubber rollers stop pulling the paper through properly and it ends up just jamming things up or sliding around. And this seems like a technology that is in need of some sort of revolution.
There's a kind of similar, it strikes me as somewhat similar, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get this fully to the, you know, top of my brain, but something that you do with, I think there's some sort of mold that can happen at the front of CRTs, like really old CRTs that some people can fix, but it is, you know, it's a massively specialized thing. So I'm not quite sure, like, you know, and that's about the end of what I just remember, you know, this is one of those things that only a few people kind of know how to do. You can see like a couple of YouTube videos. I don't know, Cindy, do you know what I'm talking about better than I do?
I know what you're talking about very much. We have a lot of equipment that is like that. And there's one company that we work with in New Jersey who is probably one of the last ones. And I don't have their name in front of me, but we have used them often to restore some of our old tubes where they will, they'll cut off the back, you know, whatever that thing is that plugs in, and take off the front and refinish the whole thing and put in the new electronics on it. Apparently a very delicate bit of work, and the most of the stuff they do is for military, mm-hmm. who are still using legacy pieces like we are. And I have seen some other YouTube videos where, you know, if you're really careful, you like peel off the front, or, you know, it's nightmarish, right? It's going to break. And so, but it can be done by professionals. And there's, you know, kind of like Terry's Rubber Rollers, there's only one place that does it. It's definitely another lost art that I'm not even sure the manuals are going to be able to help us with in the future.
Right. Yeah. Although when you mention, you know, things like the military still relying on some of these things, it's possible that the fact that there is a budget to like keep some of these things running might mean that at the very least there will continue to be one person who can do it. We'll see.
Yes, they definitely need to get some apprentices.
Right. Okay, so let's see. So as Jack mentioned, it's been a while since we recorded. So there's a news item that we should talk about, but you know, by now it's been a while. But there was recently a fairly large, you know, fire in California, you know, sort of extensive thing. And one of the things that got engulfed was a pretty large and seemingly irreplaceable archive of Hewlett-Packard like memos and things. There have been a couple of stories about this. So this was in Santa Rosa's Fountain Grove neighborhood, where a bunch of, I think what this was, and you know, so I'm not actually sure that I even have completely comprehended what was in there, but it says, you know, more than 100 boxes of things like writings and correspondence from William Hewitt and David Packard at the, you know, the sort of original garage company, right, of Silicon Valley. The thing is, it was a bunch of papers. In fact, actually, there's an even sadder part of the story, which was that it, in all the sort of corporate acquisitions and so forth, wound up getting transferred to, let's see, I think Keysight Technologies. At any rate, it physically, these documents were moved from a fire safe building to a different building that was not fire safe and was consumed by fire. So, you know, I laugh because there's almost nothing else one can do, but it's incredibly frustrating that these documents are now just plain gone. I mean, like, these were not just manuals and things like that, but like the actual sort of notes and letters and things, you know, quite possibly many of them not super important, but we will not know now. So it's a kind of a shock. It would be nice if we could have gotten this shock with something less foundational, but anyway, yeah, so I guess mainly just to point out the news stories, we have there's a couple of news stories. HP itself, HP Inc., a company formed in 2015 out of Hewlett-Packard's computer and printer businesses, released a statement that was essentially sort of downplaying, I think, what was there at the Keysight campus. But the problem is that HP split into many different pieces, and I think there still was a lot of important stuff there. Cindy, you may be even in more touch with this story than I am.
I have been following it a little bit. When the news came out, I was at a conference, the Special Interest Group for Computer and Information Science of SHOT, the Society for the History of Technology. Mm-hmm. And this made a big buzz around all the attendees at this conference, right? And every, you know, people were just, you know, shocked and dismayed and horrified, and how can this happen? And of course, as I was thinking about my own collection, is how can I prevent this from happening,
right,
to my own collection? There was, you know, some people tried to, you know, Computer History Museum has been making big efforts to collect this type of documents and could conceivably have taken this and saved it before it ended up in the weird warehouse that it was in. And, you know, this happens in a larger level too, like, you know, Digital Equipment Corporation, eventually bought by Compaq, eventually bought by HP, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, their archives are dispersed. It's hard to keep it all together when you have all these corporate acquisitions. You know, maybe you've got a big archival group who is working on keeping this stuff organized, but then perhaps they're broken up or completely dismissed as part of the acquisition. And this stuff, it's hard to keep track of. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's not a value of the leadership of the company or the people doing the acquisitions, you know, archivists can be just a squeaky noise in the wilderness, yeah, instead of something that's paid attention to as part of these great breakups and acquisitions. So it's a larger problem than just HP.
Sure.
Certainly.
Well, I mean, you know, Apple's history is fairly well preserved, I think, but Apple, you know, corporate was largely not interested in the past. I mean, they still managed to get a lot of stuff donated to Stanford, and that, you know, so it a lot of that did get preserved. But I mean, like, Apple's one of the companies I am most aware of being just like, you know, we don't look back.
That's an interesting quality of Apple. Yeah, they're not interested in their history or saving it or putting an effort into preserving it. It's an interesting decision.
Yeah. But I know that when I, you know, when this came out, I also was sort of thinking, all right, well, so a lot of what I had been doing was grabbing things, thinking, all right, well, I will. That's the reason I'm getting these is so that they don't go into the dump. You know, I can at some point in the future take the photographs, make them, get them going. You know, scan all the scannable parts and stuff like this. And it'd be just a horrible irony if what ended up happening is that I saved them in a building that then burns down. You know, before I get to it. And you know, so it did make me think, all right, I just have to get going on scanning these things, because at least if they are digitally preserved somewhere other than here, there's, you know, there's hope for it. But of course, you know, that it does, that doesn't manufacture time, unfortunately, but I do worry about it.
It would be nice to find a better way to coordinate our efforts of scanning. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, maybe a BitSaver is that the central repository of scans of things? Or is there, you know, is there a union catalog of interesting stuff scanned about computers and computer history and technical drawings and documents? And there isn't really. There's a lot of this disparate efforts with hobbyists and museums and projects in universities, and it would be nice to find a way to bring that together so we're not duplicating effort. Mm-hmm. Because scanning is, you know, time consuming.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely can be.
Yeah, ultimately a great thing. You know, you get three copies in three different places, and then it's there, saved.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so sometimes when I look at the scans that are out there, I can be a little bit snobbish and think, well, yes, but my scan of this is better, you know. but you know, so there's some things that, you know, also stuff that was scanned 15 years ago was scanned at a resolution that is terrible. You know, so sometimes even knowing that something is out there may not be enough to keep me from scanning it a second time, but, you know.
Yeah. And then are you scanning it in a format that is going to last into the future?
Right, exactly.
Just like we were talking about, you know, these Apple apps, you know, going up in smoke. If, you know, if you're scanning it in, I don't know, Word 1, there's nothing else, nothing is going to be able to read it
right
later. So there's also migrating your scan into the future. You know, it's a big mess. It's a big project to save, digitally save things.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly comes up with, even when we're not talking about scans, but just like documents. I mean, like if you have a document in Bank Street Writer, you know.
Right.
You know, sometimes it's fairly comprehensible. You can squeeze a lot of the text out, but sometimes there are fancy tricks that they do with like changing the high bit of something so that to indicate the end of a line or a shift or something. And yeah, it's a tough question, but I mean, like it would be interesting to know, you know, here I have these 15 things I could be scanning. These two nobody has ever scanned before, you know. That would be good to know.
Yeah, we're definitely doing that. You know, we check on BitSavers and other places to see if it's already been done, and if it's good enough, I'm going to move on to the next thing. But keep the physical copy, too.
Sure.
That's what we do.
I know that, I don't know if we've ever talked on the show to Jason Scott, but we've definitely, you know, talked about Jason Scott at the Internet Archive, who does a lot of kind of like cheerleading for scanners and a lot of uploading of things himself. That, you know, he has kind of an approach where it's like, just do the thing now, organize it later, you know, so that, you know, we can beat the fire or the, you know, the, whatever, the bits falling off the disks. And there's some merit to that, but it does lead to a fairly diffuse set of scans.
That reminds me, there's one project they have going on right now that Kevin Savitz is leading the charge on, scanning some, I don't really understand what this is about, this guy named Ted Nelson who saved a ton of junk mail, and they're trying to scan it all.
Yeah, he's got like 30 boxes of junk mail.
Right.
It's amazing. It's amazing stuff, really. Beautiful drawings and text and graphic design. And what a great collection.
Yep, it's pretty amazing. And I've seen them posting stuff on Twitter now and then, talking about what they're scanning and talking about the degree to which they are in the red on this, because I'm not sure what the costs are all about, but they're actively looking for donations.
Right. Yeah, it's so. Kevin has been, he's basically been, you know, paying somebody for their time to go through and scan these properly and get them uploaded. And he's been sort of, he's got a spreadsheet where he's keeping track of like what he's paid and, you know, what he's paid in labor,
right,
and you know, what he's collected. And I think it's broken even as I'm speaking now, but of course that's changeable. Donations are still encouraged.
Right.
But yeah, so my understanding is it's basically Ted Nelson had, you know, basically checked all the reader service cards, you know, numbers, and gotten all kinds of people to send the tech stuff,
right,
to him, and then he saved it. And sometimes he's made little notations on it, and that's also interesting.
So back to this Hewlett Packard, though. This
that's right. That's where we were.
I'll bring it back home. It does look like a really interesting set. You know, it was correspondence, speeches, kind of personal, more personal than business stuff. So, but we'll never know now.
Yeah.
Because it's gone now. You never know when that fire is going to come blazing through your neighborhood.
Right. Yep.
You think it's never, but then it happens. You know, I tell you, over here at the museum, we've been working really hard on our disaster preparedness. Mm-hmm. Plan, sort of with a fire lit under us from this HP
right.
thing.
Right, sure. I mean, I guess I was sort of thinking, to the extent that I can't manufacture time to do the scanning, you know, at least what can I protect in waterproof bins and that kind of stuff, at least, you know? Doesn't help with the fire, but, you know, like, whatever. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's water, mold, extremes, temperature.
Mold and mildew actually is kind of an interesting issue because, you know, I am getting things from people's basements, people's garages, you know, and some of it does come in pretty stinky, you know, and you know, I want to isolate that so that it, you know, it doesn't spread. And also I'd prefer not to have it like floating around in my airspace as well. But, you know, so trying to figure out how to handle that is a whole separate question.
Yes, yes, it is, exactly. You don't want to mix it with the rest of your stuff, or it'll infect your entire collection. So, you know, is it valuable? Is it dupes? Can you find a copy of it someplace else? If so, get rid of it.
Yeah, might actually be better in the long run.
If it's really valuable, you know, put on your face mask and scan it. Throw it away.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to bring myself to do that with some of these things, but it does sort of feel like, you know, once it has been documented, it really isn't doing any... No one is going to want this anymore. So, and Cindy, I guess actually you have the next thing here, which transitions quite nicely from a story about a fire, the friendly orange glow. But what is this?
Well, Brian Deere just published a book called The Friendly Orange Glow, which is the history of Plato, which was an early networked computer system from around the mid-70s, started in the University of Illinois. Plato was a terminal, actually a flat screen plasma terminal that was part of it. It was a touch screen that deployed curricula or educational stuff, but it was networked, and so all of the people who used it developed all of the things that we've come familiar with bulletin boards and the internet as well, like email and chatting and flirting and falling in love and, you know, playing games, playing multiplayer games. So this whole thing grew up around this educational system that it turned out that the curricula is okay for remedial education, but it was the thing itself that people would use to play online games and communicate with one another was the real star of Plato. And it kind of developed in its own island apart from bulletin boards and apart from ARPANET. And the people who know about it are really fond of it, hence the friendly, right? It's orange because it's this plasma screen.
Uh-huh.
We've got one here in the museum, which is really nice, and it connects to these people who have saved all the curricula and games and capabilities If you go to cyberone.org, you can also download an emulator from them and try it out yourself on your own computer.
Huh.
It's just really extra cool and fun to explore what it was like, and maybe you can even run into some people and chat with them there.
Cool.
Yeah, I know that kind of thing comes up. The availability of people to chat with comes up when people talk about, I forget what this was called, but the Commodore 64 based network that existed. Oh, geez, whatever. It was the predecessor to, I think, Apple Inc. and then AOL. But the problem with trying to run these things in modern times is that it was all about the community. Mm. But yet, now you have maybe like one person every 2 weeks logging in and missing each other. Yeah, so that's one aspect that's kind of hard to capture, even when you get the hardware and the simulate the connections and that sort of thing. You still, I kind of wonder, if there are such things that should be captured now, like Facebook or something, just through video, because someday Facebook is either going to be gone or just mutate into something unrecognizable, and you're not going to be able to get the experience just by having a Facebook simulator.
Right.
They have a bunch of Russian bots talk to you or whatever, right?
Right.
But
well, the cool thing is here on the website on cyberone.org, it shows that there are, at this moment, 32 users currently signed in. So people are actually using it right now, which is pretty neat.
Cool. So maybe this is where the community is.
Yeah. It's going to be fun to give a try. I remember hearing about, reading about Plato in the early 80s, and at some point I found some sort of Plato terminal software that ran on the Atari 8-bit. And I remember getting that software, and actually I found somewhere that I could dial in to this, but I was probably on a 300 baud modem at the time, and it was not fast enough to be usable in any meaningful way. So it'd be cool to actually finally see what this actually looked like. Because I've never really tried it out.
Hmm. Well, yeah, and I, just looking at Wikipedia, I had associated Plato with CDC, which, big Control Data Corporation, big, if not a big Minnesota company, at least a big Minnesota presence. That's where I sort of grew up. So I remember, hearing about CDC and Plato. Never actually had used it, but it comes up every once in a while. I think one of the early Apple II software companies called Muse was formed from people who came from Plato, Plato backgrounds.
Yeah, CDC bought Plato and the curricula later on in its incarnation,
mm-hmm.
And it was always running off of different CDC computers, including a 6600, and before that, I think it was a CDC 1604, and then after that, a Cyber 70, perhaps. You'll have to check my numbers. So it was related very much to the CDC computers,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually purchased by CDC, who I think killed it after a while.
Yeah, well.
Right. They didn't see the glory of chatting.
Right. Well, and I think they probably had a lot of other larger business focuses.
Mm-hmm.
So, and actually, not hearing you say CDC, it reminds me that you have the CDC 6500 there. That was I forget where we were we recording when we talked about that, like reattaching all those wires.
I don't know, but we do have a CDC 6500, which took, its three bays were cut with a bolt cutters.
Yeah.
So that was the first problem, is attaching all the wires. And of course, part of the timing is based on the length of the wires.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So,
unreal. Yeah, there's a
unreal
video, though.
Yeah.
I see. We can link to that. I'm sure. And I know we talked about this on some previous episode, but
it's great. It's hard to keep this thing running, and we've got our best engineers on it. And when it is running, you can get an account on it and run NOS and play chess and do some other things. You can even, there's a little community that has developed around it who have figured out how to communicate with one another when they're online. Not necessarily chat, but send messages back and forth. So it's up there waiting for you to do neat things with.
Excellent. Cool. So now that the news is done, we can talk a little bit about upcoming shows. So, I failed to quite finish doing the research on the Fostum thing. Have you looked at that?
Yeah, a little bit. So basically, Fostum is this free software event that I have some colleagues who've been to it a few years, and they seem to like it a lot. And what's new this year? I mean, they always have a CFP where people can submit things for all sorts of stuff. What's new this year is they actually have a focus on retro computing. They have the Retro Computing Dev Room for the first time, and so they're offering. They're encouraging people to submit proposals for talks about emulation and open source hardware and software and use of retro computing today, all the kinds of things that our listeners are into. So if you're interested in giving a talk about the cool stuff you've been doing with retro computing in February of 2018, Fostum is the thing for you.
Yeah, that looks pretty wild. February 3rd to 4th.
Yep.
Cool. And then, after having done that, you can go to Seattle to the Living Computers Museum and Labs for VCF Pacific Northwest, February 10th to 11th. So how is that? So Cindy, how is that? Are you involved at all in the preparation for that, or is this mainly just a space that's hosted in?
Well, this is the first time that LCM is hosting the VCF, although we have presented at the one at Computer History Museum the last couple of years. So it's more on the side of events than my side of collections, although I'll probably do my part by taking people on tours in the basement and the third floor to show our collections, kind of give a little back-of-house thing. So that will be my part, and it's sure to be very cool. And we'll get some great speakers, and there's a lot of people up here. There's a lot of enthusiasm about vintage computing. And you know, VCF always has a contest, so it's competitive.
Yeah.
So people are trying to make show something really cool. So I'm looking forward to it, having this one and having a long relationship with VCF.
Yeah, it's a pretty neat organization that, you know, is sort of supporting all of the regional shows. I'm sad to say I have not actually been to any VCF events. I've visited the InfoAge Museum site where VCF East is held, but I haven't actually been to the event itself. So, but I know Earl Evans, who's, you know, one of the regular discussants on this podcast, but isn't here today, obviously. But I know he's up in Portland, and he's very enthusiastic about this happening. So I'm sure you'll see him there.
That sounds great.
And hopefully we'll get a sort of afterwards report from him. But all right, I think that's it for the upcoming shows that we'll mention. We're a little too late to mention the Vintage Computer Festival Switzerland, which is just ending, or maybe has just ended a couple hours before we started recording. So I hope it was fun though. All right, and now a word from our sponsor.
This is where America's peace of mind begins. Around the clock, radar's electronic eyes watch the skies and report what they see to SAGE, Defense System of the United States Air Force. Here is a SAGE center on 24-hour alert. At its heart is a computer developed by a research team from MIT and IBM working with the Air Force. Every scheduled flight across American frontiers is recorded ahead of time on IBM punch cards, then fed into the SAGE computer. Now the computer can draw a picture of what is supposed to be in the sky at any moment. It continually compares this expected picture with the real picture as seen by radar. If a flying object does not belong, it appears on this viewing screen. There's one now at the right of the screen. They call it a blip. The officer fires a light gun at the target blip. This tells the computer to track the object. At the launching site, a long-range Bomark missile is readied for firing. Now they ask the computer to calculate an intercept point. X marks the spot where the Bomark missile would meet the moving target if fired immediately.
What are those?
Those are launch codes.
What are they for?
Joshua's trying to find the right code so he can launch the missiles himself.
At this rate, it'll hit the launch codes in 5.3 minutes.
Mr. McKittrick? After very careful consideration, sir, I've come to the conclusion that your new defense system...
And we're back. All right, so I am the host, and so that makes me responsible for the selection of the host's gift idea. And I think it, sort of together we decided that the gift for this time will be a kind of a do-it-yourself project. It's a Instructables recipe, or whatever you call it, to construct a floppy disk bag. So if you follow the link here, it's a terrible, terrible looking thing that you can make out of. I didn't even count how many floppy disks. It's made out of 3.5-inch floppy disks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 33. I don't know. So something around 40, 3.5-inch floppy disks. So, you know, some installation of Microsoft Windows and you'll be set, I think. And it just the way you build it is drill little holes and link them together with little little clips, and you can build a little carry bag made of so each side is like 3x4 floppy disks, and it's one floppy disk in width, I guess, and it just looks terrible in a interesting retro way.
Yep, it's pretty amazing. So, one of the things I love about this, in the text of this, it says that this bag is created as proof of concept for the real project, which is to make plate mail armor out of these floppies.
Perfect. Perfect. That's excellent.
Yep. Pretty good.
All right. Well, so anyway, so, you know, in the spirit of the holidays giving season or whatever, you can make your loved ones something that they will always remember and quite possibly never cherish, but at any rate.
Oh, man.
All right. Well, okay, so now we can move on to eBay, maybe during the times when you're taking a break from building your ugly 3.5-inch floppy disk bag. So this time I'll start with the eBay auctions, and I'll try to rein myself in a little bit here. The first one I wanted to mention was this is now a complete auction. It was sort of interesting to see it go by. It's an IBM 360 Model 40 mainframe CPU operator panel. And it is, you know, it is what you think it is. It's one of these iconic IBM 360 control panels. It looks beautiful. And the owner of it said that, you know, all the sort of the wires on the back were clipped nicely. So that they could be, I don't know. I mean, like, it's obviously it's not operational and it is just a panel, but it does look beautiful. And it sold, as you might expect for something of that sort, for $7,200. So I was not really in the running for it, but I would love to find one, you know, this nice in someone's attic.
Sure.
So this looks like the model. This looks similar to the Model 30 one, right, Cindy?
It's not unlike the Model 30.
Okay.
The same form factor.
Uh-huh. Nice blue and red and white and knobs and things.
Uh-huh. And if you look at the back, all of those wires are yellow.
Uh-huh.
Every last one of them. They look exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, so planned.
Once they're clipped, good luck.
Ouch. All right, so the next thing, just sort of sticking on the IBM for a second, is... these are, the title of it says Vintage IBM COBOL Coding Forms, Blank Sheets. But what they are, they're basically grid paper, graph paper, which is designed for figuring out, first of all, like how your reports are going to work. You know, so there's a 140-character print chart. And then there are COBOL forms that are designed for printing, for sort of like designing your COBOL programs on paper. And so that's interesting. I imagine they're probably not used very much anymore, but you can buy it now for $40. I think they look pretty cool.
Cool.
And sort of sticking on the COBOL theme as well, I have something which, to me, I mean, so admittedly, I am not that well versed in the things that there are for the Commodore 64 and 128, but I did not realize that COBOL did not seem like one of the things that you would have on the Commodore 128. But here is COBOL, the COBOL system, designed for students and programmers by Abacus software, I guess, just Abacus, for the Commodore 128. You know, if you have a Commodore 128 and a desire to learn COBOL,
this is the way.
That is some great models,
yeah,
too, using it
yeah,
on the cover of that box.
I think this is a time when they didn't really quite understand. The photography group was probably not part of the design group or the users groups. So, oh, it's sold. All right, I had kind of an interesting pick. There was an external 2.88 megabyte, I presume, floppy drive for Next Computers that was that I had in the listing, and it's a SCSI device. It looks like a 3.5-inch drive. In the front it has the little hole for putting in the paperclip to eject, and it's designed to look like a Next. It is not, as far as I there's no reason to think that it is any kind of official product. It's in the sort of shape of a Next. It would look appropriate sitting next to a Next pizza box, Next station. But so I thought it was kind of cool to see, the few non-Next peripherals that were made for the Next before the whole enterprise folded.
Oh, so this was actually not made by Next.
No.
Okay.
Well, it looks quite generic, yeah. Actually, when you look at the label,
right.
And stuff.
Interesting.
But it's clearly supposed to be sitting next to a Next station.
Right. Yeah. And yet, the labels, there's no label saying Next or anything. So, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Actually, here's one more old IBM-related thing that I thought was kind of cool. It is an IBM aptitude test for programmers. And I think I managed to figure out what year this was from, but it's from, 1964, yes. It is really sort of old-school programming aptitude. I'd be kind of curious to take such a thing.
Yeah.
See how I do.
This would be really cool.
So it's a it's not going to be about being certified on Novell or anything.
I think we bought one of those about a year ago. Uh-huh. I don't remember it having those. This one has some sort of scoring sheet.
Yeah, like an grading overlay.
Yeah, exactly. That looks pretty neat. So yeah, we were thinking of. Reprinting some phases of it,
uh-huh.
And putting it out, letting some of our museum visitors see if they had the aptitude.
I think
that'd be cool.
It would be hilarious to know. It'd be sort of depressing if I didn't, but whatever. I guess it's conceivable that would be saying something more about the test. I would have to say to myself. But. The other thing, I put this in. I know this was actually just there last night, it went pretty quickly. But there's a Packard Bell corner computer, and so I don't know if I've ever talked about this before. It's not vintage in any real sense, but its design is just this sort of hilarious thing that it's very appealing, and I think it is actually somewhat sought after because of this. So it's like a I think in 1991 kind of era machine. It runs with Windows 95 installed. And so I guess maybe it's a 95 era machine. But it's designed in this kind of weird way where it's designed to sit in a corner. So it has drives and stuff on two sides and the other two sides are flat. And it's got this sort of cylinder in the middle. And I think actually the design of this was by the same person who did the frog design stuff for Apple and the sort of Apple IIc era.
Hmm.
So it has kind of a history as well. But, it's probably not a great computer, but it just looks kind of cool.
Yeah, it's kind of funky looking. I dig it.
And so I guess it is true, though, that they're desired because it was a buy it now sold for $335. So it's probably one of the only Windows 95 boxes that would sell for that. Maybe one other thing I'll mention is there's a Heathkit Hero 1 robot, which I've always been kind of pleased about these. This one, the problem is, of course, they're from a long time ago and not many people bought them, and those that bought them didn't always preserve them that well. So this particular robot is, all the side panels are, I guess, gone, either broken or just gone. There are some homemade side panels that the the owner made. It's unclear whether they're going to be included. The owner believes that it looks better without the side panels. It does seem to have the wheels. It's missing. I think in these, I think they usually had some kind of foam that went in the front because they have some sort of, I think, sonic locators in the front. These things, when I see them, I just can't help but see like a baboon. They have this sort of baboon face shape to them. But anyway, there's foam around those front locators that almost always has deteriorated anytime I've seen it. And in this case, it's just gone. So at least that might be better. This might be as close as you're going to get to finding one of these because they don't come up very often. But it is a $650 buy it now. And I think it might be, I guess they say they will ship it from New Jersey. So anyway, interesting to look at.
Yeah, that is mighty keen looking, and it does look better without the panels on. Actually, I haven't seen one of these either.
I do keep on the lookout for them, and I know I wanted one when they were new, but I've never seen one that's even approximately something I could get. So, and often like the arms are broken. I mean, it's plastic, and also it's Heathkit. So, this one in particular was wired together by Heathkit. But I think some of them that you find were also sold as kits, so you never know how good the person was who put it together.
Right.
Okay, yeah, I think I'll leave that there, because, you know, I've gone through enough. Jack, you have listed on the show notes a gripe.
Yeah, so my only eBay note route right now is I just want to complain, because I've been trying for a while to get an Atari 7800 video game console, and it's frustrating because I'm in Sweden, of course, and these things, there's a ton of these in the U.S. always for sale on eBay, and they're pretty cheap, and they don't ship to Sweden.
Ah.
And the European ones don't come up nearly as often. There have been a couple that were, like, really sweet and a good price, and I missed it just because of eBay's website being stupid, right? Like, I'm trying to type in my bid, and, like, something goes wrong.
Ah.
To me, it seems weird. Like, I look at eBay, and it's like, do you have any other web-based system that you use in your daily life that has such a clearly, like, old, weird, defunct design in terms of web design? I don't know. It bothers me. That's all.
Sorry.
I just want to rant. Yeah, I do hold you responsible, Paul.
Yeah.
Apology not accepted.
Okay. No, I mean, I get kind of nervous whenever they change anything, though, because, like, I'm worried, okay, well, something's, like, now the button's not going to work or something, you know. I have had it happen, I think, you know, where I'm waiting to snipe the thing, and I hit the button, and it says, okay, please log in. And I'm like, oh, no, I've got 4 seconds left, I can't, or something. So sometimes I will double-check that now just to be careful. Or, you know, we'll sometimes have it running both on a browser and on the phone, and, you know, they don't say the same time. You know, like, I've got 10 seconds left on the browser, but 6 on the phone. So,
Oh, well.
So, Cindy, you had a couple that you had pointed out.
Well, I'm always looking at eBay, too. There's a couple of neat things. I like this DisplayWrite 4 word processing software.
Mm-hmm.
That is for the IBM DisplayWriter.
Interesting.
Of which we have a couple that may or may not work. Although, is it for a DisplayWriter?
I wonder if it's for interfacing with a DisplayWriter.
Although our DisplayWriter has only 8-inch disk drives. So this is interesting in that these are 5 1/4. So there must be some 5 1/4-inch disk drives that hook into this DisplayWriter as well, which...
Well, I'm looking at the description a bit, and it seems like they're saying they ported the software to the PC later. And so I guess this is that.
Ah.
So it's the software from the DisplayWriter ported
okay,
to the PC.
Okay, I see. Ported to the PC. Yeah. Well, that's even more interesting, because I probably could make it go. Uh-huh. And... trying to collect interesting examples of word processing programs that we can make it available in the exhibit hall. Uh-huh. And this is a nice, obscure one.
The display writers look... I see them every once in a while coming up, and they look very pleasing. They do have this nice IBM look to them.
The display... The CPU itself is kind of a 5150-ish looking box on which is a, say, a quarter sphere that the terminal sits on. So the terminal will like rock back and forth on this weird quarter sphere thing.
I see. Yeah, I found a photo.
Yeah, and then the disk drives itself, the 8-inch disk drives, are sort of like a toaster.
Right. Yeah, actually, that's the disk drives are the thing that looks almost the most kind of like iconic of this setup. Like if you, that's the thing that tells you it's a display writer.
So, yeah, so that's pretty neat, this software. I also like the Vector Pack System breadboarding catalog, which is ended.
Somebody else liked it, too.
Because, yeah, it looks, if you're buying paper, condition.
Right.
And it's very pretty. But we've got some pretty good breadboarding catalogs here, too, but not this one.
That company seemed to be very big. I mean, like, I've seen them, like, usually I'm focused on Apple II stuff, and so I've seen, Vector things that will, mm-hmm. breadboards for Apple II or Apple III, but they made them for everything. I mean, they made lots and lots of these things. In whatever shape you needed. It's very cool. And I guess if this is a 1973 catalog, it's not going to include any for the Apple II.
And just to brag a little bit, there's another one that just closed, a Interdata Model 80 with tapes. Now, this is interesting because it's a 16-bit Interdata, and there was, I think, a dozen boxes of paper tapes coming along with this. And there is very little known 16-bit software for this Interdata. And it looks like these tapes included BOSS, which is an operating system for the Interdata, and also something called MTOS, which is a time-sharing operating system for the Interdata. So... our engineers are really pretty excited about this, and we might end up restoring this next year because it's yet another good example of time-sharing operating systems that we could conceivably put online for other people to enjoy.
So you're saying you bought this actual one that we're looking at?
Yes, we bought this one.
Yeah, it looks fantastic, this pile of tapes that's there. I mean, that's amazing. Do you know much about where it came from?
No, this Progress Electronics Company? Mm-hmm. No. Now, sometimes it's, this provenance, it's probably passed a couple of hands from scrappers, this and that, so I'll have to research it once it comes in and write it up.
Because this looks, it looks like it would be just quite fun to dig through, a couple different copies of the memory test program, maybe there's people's comments in the source code, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see things that say, like, BOSS object, and now I kind of wonder if that means somewhere the source is here. it looks delightful. And also priced at the kind of level that a museum and not a person would get. But
cool.
So I'm glad. And also I'm glad it went to someplace where even I'll still be able to see, the results at some point.
Yeah, hopefully it's not going to be trapped in our basement forever, but we'll do something with it.
The machine itself looks quite pretty. So that is not it's not a magnetic tape drive. That's a paper tape drive, or
this looks like a magnetic tape drive.
Yeah,
I must say, I my engineers were very excited by this, and I will have to catalog the documents and take a look at it to figure it out myself. How about that?
Looks really cool, though.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah. And you have to wonder how many of these things are, still out there sitting in someone's, back storeroom or something.
Whenever we think that we've got it all, another amazing thing comes out of somebody's basement. Yeah. So.
Both good and bad, I guess.
Yes, both good and bad, exactly. Like, we're running out of room, too.
Yeah, and I suppose it's probably the case that you also need to filter out what, you know, like, you don't need another 28 Commodore 64s, right?
Yeah, I've already got probably 30 of them. You know, unless I'm going to, say, put them in the educational program and let kids take them apart.
Sure, yeah.
Right, in which case I could use another 38, but it just depends.
All right. Cool. So I think that'll close out the eBay section and bring us to the final closing, you know, points of the show. When was this? I guess this actually was only just a weekend ago. So, in fact, it was a week ago today that I saw the PDP-8E that was sitting in the computer room, actually the computer lab, I guess, in the undergrad college that Jack and I both went to. So I was able to see a couple of people, and I don't know if it's still able to be run or if it's really just a room decoration, but it was there in a current modern computer lab. I took a little photo of it. So it looks pretty. It looks actually exactly like I remember seeing it with the same like piece of paper taped to it. But I never actually was among the people who used it, but it's still there.
I used it a little bit. Jeff Ondick brought it in because he had used it when he was a student. He got it from some other place, and he'd used one of these. So he brought it in for us to try out and play with.
Ah, okay.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. I didn't know that was his. But...
And we had at that time, though, it was still mounted in a big rack, as I recall.
Right.
With, like, there was some sort of non-functioning paper tape drive in there also. And I just remember there was just a huge, like, jumble of paper tape down in the bottom of the rack. But all that was non-functional. But I think the photo I saw you posted was just the unit itself, right? Not in the rack?
Yeah, I was expecting it to be in a rack, and I didn't, you know, that was all there was left, which is why I'm wondering if it functions at all. But maybe it has everything internal.
Yeah, I think that the time that it was that we were there, like the only functioning part of it was a pretty small bit of what was on that rack.
Okay, but so. It was pretty cool to see though. So I think he arrived, Jeff Ondick, to the school just before we did, and so like as far as I knew that thing was always there, but apparently, it came with him.
Yeah, because I took a class from him and he was talking about it because he brought it in. Specifically because he had used it when he was studying, and like we were doing assembly programming on it or machine language programming, and it was very laborious. You have to enter it in sort of one word at a time, and part of what he had us do were things that were sort of like puzzles. Like, can you write a program that will zero out the entire memory of the machine, including the program itself?
So it's like early copy production.
So
yeah,
that was fun.
I can do this. Yeah, you can do this by pulling the power. But I can't figure out a good way to integrate, since I don't teach actually like generally computer related things. I can't figure out a way to integrate these old computers into anything that I teach. But I did bring I'm teaching a computational linguistics class, and I have one of the things I was talking about was it was regular expressions, but you know the T9. Text entry system where you can sort of type a number of numbers and it will figure out like based on the you know the alphabet on
yeah.
the phone keys, you know, what you could have meant, you know, so some combination is only most likely to be dentist,
right.
You know, even though it could have been other things, and it looks stuff up in a dictionary to try to figure this out. But so I brought in a rotary phone so I could show them the, you know, the ABCDEF on the things. You know, that was about as close as I could come to figuring out a way to integrate this stuff into my classes. But
well, you do what you can.
Probably not worth it, but it was kind of fun, at least. It was just sitting there, you know, and as I was heading to class, and I thought, oh, I can bring that.
Cool.
There's one link I gave you called, at any rate, they are using vintage computers in digital humanities types classes.
Uh-huh.
Because they're kind of so slow and limited, it helps people understand, like non-computer people understand how computers work and can be a part of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. No, it's there. I swear, it's there. And I haven't read all of their things. One of the articles was like old languages on old computers, where they're discussing using these old computers as part of a teaching tool.
It's in this minimal computing.
Minimal computing, yeah, that's the one.
It's funny thinking about some of these things, just sort of in terms of the fact that people who are currently going through college and stuff like that, they just never ever experienced anything like this in a way. You know, like as far as they're concerned, it was always, I mean, actually, sort of almost as long as they've been kind of conscious beings, there's been a little magic device in their hand that connects to the world. And to a certain extent, I think they probably are aware of kind of the way things were before, but it's different from actually really typing, you know, on an actual keyboard where the keys go down, stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think especially there's so much happening so fast that for young people today, like even what happened earlier in their life is a blur, let alone what happened 10, 20, 30 years before. Like my kids now who are teenagers, they're at the point where they don't remember how to use a DVD player, even though they were watching DVD movies by the hundred 5 and 10 years ago. And now they're just like, oh, it's on DVD. Oh, wait, Dad, I don't know how to do that. Is that still hooked up to the TV? How does this work? Like, they're just like, they're so lost because they're so engulfed in the new all the time.
Yeah. Well, it was half their life ago, too,
That's
right?
That's true.
Someone recently told me that they were with their kid in a Jeep that didn't have automatic windows. And the kid looks at this crank thing and is like, what is this thing? What does it do? He had to reach over and go, here, it rolls down the window.
Yeah. It just wasn't so long ago. That's the frightening thing is, you know, like I'm sure that we all have this experience where, you know, when you're a kid, that you see time differently. I mean, you know, that a year is a really long time. And, you know, when I look back at what like happened in computers in 1982, I mean, it's hard to imagine that so much could have so much could have happened in that space because it doesn't seem like it was very long.
So at any rate, these minimal computings, they're using an 8800 to like analyze the word counts of chapters of novels. And it takes, you know, all day.
So you have real incentive to optimize.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. Hey, I came across that a little bit in the this computational linguistics class, because I mean, essentially what that's talking about is dealing with big data, you know, big corpora and stuff like that. But the computers are fast enough now that you don't even, you can make a bad program and it'll still be done in 3 seconds. So it's a little bit frustrating when you see just like how inefficient some of the stuff that people turn in is. Cindy, do you have any other sort of closing thoughts you wanted to add before we finish up?
I thank you for taking the time to listen to me, and it's been great chatting with you. I hope to come on another occasion, too, with other people.
Oh, yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great to have you here, and we would love to have you back whenever you can. Thanks a lot for providing all the insight into the Living Computers Museum and Labs.
LCM&L, that's us.
All right, so I guess then that I will say that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast and join our Facebook group, which is at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to us by email at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network of podcasts at throwbacknetwork.net, where you can find other sort of retro-themed shows. Please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute!